Let's come back to Kohler for a moment. You commented about Beezer being out of date, and Kohler's being mechanistically oriented, which was relatively new. We're talking 1932 or so.
Yeah.
How did the two? I don't have the dates in my mind. How did the two compare in age?
Well, Kohler that year was either 72 or 73. Before the course was over, had ended, he was dead of a brain tumor. And so as that course went on, he, there would be interruptions in his lecturing, and that was the first time when Bartlett would substitute him. And after he died, of course, as far as Bartlett's career is concerned, Bartlett continued with that course. It was called Chemistry 5 in those days. And it's interesting from the point of view of the history of chemistry in the United States, at least enormously interesting to me, that Paul took that course, not only brought it up to date, in a way that a 73-year-old man who's dying of brain cancer isn't really bringing it up to date, but trying very hard, and certainly, instilling in you the notion that it's in theory and mechanism and so on, that's where the heart of organic chemistry beats. It doesn't beat in synthesis and so forth, and that's a form of applied organic chemistry. Organic chemistry is is understanding how you transform one structure of matter into another structure of matter. So it is to some extent a philosophical attitude toward organic chemistry that was instilled by Kohler and then carried on and developed to the highest degree at that time, I think, by Bartlett. Now, Bartlett, having been at Harvard, had then under his tutelage some undergraduates. That by itself didn't have much influence on organic chemistry in the United States, because so few of the Harvard undergraduates went on for PhDs. Then, now, I mean, Harvard is all the 20 years I've been there. This is an aside, but all the 20 years or so that I've been there, it's been plus or minus five plus or minus one undergraduate who would go on for a PhD in chemistry, all of chemistry. So that it's a funny undergraduate body. It's not an MIT bunch of undergraduates, that's for sure. But at the graduate level, of course, all graduate students had to take Chemistry 5, Bartlett's course. And it was through that course that the importance of physical mechanistic organic chemistry spread through the United States, because at the same time, three quarters of a graduating class wanted, first of all, a job in academic research teaching. And those that got it then were very proud to introduce a course that wasn't available no matter where they went, Illinois or wherever. There wasn't a course in mechanistic organic chemistry, and so really in the span of within 10 or 15 years, that became a standard item in the senior graduate curriculum of chemistry departments in the United States, and finally led, of course, to the death of the course, because graduate students would then come back in later years having had the equivalent, no longer taking Paul's course, Paul's heart breaking and what am I doing wrong? It's that he had done it so well. And it's, you know, and it has worked its influence right down into the undergraduate, the upper class undergraduate level. So, but Kohler played an enormously important, he played a key role in my going on with organic chemistry. I don't know, perhaps because of this childhood, had very, very little self-confidence. And I was sure all those years I was in Belmont Hill School that, well, there'd be no way for me to go to college because look at these fellow students around here who are doing well. And the only reason I got into college was that it was very easy to get into Harvard. All you had to do was apply. And in those days, and you would, and when you got in, they told you, well, you know, by the November hour examinations, a fair number of you will be asked to leave, and by the end of the year, one third of you will be gone, and one third was gone. Well, you can imagine the effect that that had on the troops that remained, right?
Yes.
Well, in the first place, you felt damn good that you survived, but more important, you worked very hard in order to survive, or you didn't, and you were bounced out. So it was a completely different atmosphere. But if it hadn't been for that, I mean, today I never would have gotten into college. I mean, with all those damn exams. Mm-hmm. Well, this persisted so that by the time I was a senior, I had no idea that I was going to stay in chemistry. I had become very interested in sociology. There was a fascinating professor of biochemistry at Harvard, Lawrence Henderson. He was a physical biochemist who established the relation of the partial pressure relation of carbon dioxide, oxygen, and what else in the blood. And that was he'd sort of worked out the physical chemistry of the transport of carbon dioxide and how these things interacted with one another. And then had lost interest in biochemistry and become interested in the application of scientific method to the interaction of groups of human beings, but the interaction of human beings. Could you apply scientific method to sociology fundamentally? And he is not the originator of that, but he latched on to the work of an Italian economist, Pareto, Vilfredo Pareto, who had tried to develop what I was going to say was to convert sociology into a science, but in any event, it was to approach problems in sociology with the methods of science into which one can go, but this isn't the place. And my father had become interested in it somehow. He knew Lawrence Henderson and suggested that I take this graduate seminar that Henderson gave in sociology, but it was really, of course, in reading the four volumes of Pareto's Mind and Society. Well, why I enjoyed that so much, I'll never know. I just became infatuated with it, and I kept up, of course. I was majoring in chemistry, and so I kept up those courses. My grades gradually declined. And that's another reason why George Kistiakowsky has always been pissed off. I ended up getting a C in his physical chemistry course. But meanwhile, I was spending for no credit at all. You couldn't take the course for credit. Spending all this time on this aspect of sociology. And so by the time I was, you know, nearing the end, it was a question whether I should go into sociology or go into chemistry. And not having any confidence that I should do either, my father arranged to take me around to Henderson and to talk about that problem of where should I go, what should I do. And Henderson was very clear. He said, you have a knack for this kind of thing, and you're obviously interested in it, and you could certainly do it well. And the choice, he knew Kohler very well, of course, and Kohler had, well, I'll come back to what Kohler had said, but he said something to me which was absolutely decisive. He said, if you're the kind of person who can tolerate knowing where you are in the world, that is, what the value of your work, your contributions is, then you should go into chemistry. If you can't tolerate that, then you should go into sociology. And wow, what an impact that had on what, as I look back, was still a very little boy. So I said, well, okay, I guess I'm mad enough to know where I am in the world and not worry about it too much. Meanwhile, Kohler was encouraging me to go to graduate school, and that came, you know, as a complete surprise, because here were all these teaching assistants knowing so much and really had no notion of going on for graduate school, and would not have without his encouragement. And he said, well, if it's a matter of money, I will get you a teaching job at Hobart College. I can remember Hobart College. And you go there for a couple of years and save up a little money, and then you can come back to graduate school. Well, in fact, it wasn't any question of money. My grandfather, who had been a minor industrialist here in Philadelphia, had left me $10,000, and that was really a lot of money at a time when tuition at Harvard was $400 and so on, I got a partial scholarship and so forth, and so I ended up never having to work my way through graduate school or as a teaching assistant or anything like that. But it didn't cost very much if you didn't spend very much, and and if you were careful in those days, you had to pay for your own breakage, that is. And so if you were careful about that, then your bill at the end of the year wasn't so tremendous. But when Kohler said that, I just took his word for it. That he must be a better judge of me than I was. So this old man really was a major, major influence. And I just worshipped him. You know, I mean, he was just so perfect. And the notion that he was still teaching and enthusiastic at 73, even now, you see, makes a big difference in my life. I'm 73 years old, and I still think it's the greatest fun and just the most wonderful thing to be able to continue doing research and so forth. And without Kohler as a model, who's to say? Right?
Did you do any research as an undergraduate?
Yes. Yeah, I did. In that chemistry... Yes, in the senior year I was doing a little research with Kohler. I then wanted to do my graduate work with him, of course. And he had agreed that that would be possible, and he gave me a little problem to make cysts 1,2-dibromocyclohexane, the only isomer known being the trans, the product that, and he was, you know, fully aware of the importance of that and what would it do on elimination and so forth. Well, dear God, I mean, neither he nor I had a clue as to how to make cysts. Many years later, somebody did make cysts 1,2-dibromocyclohexane. And, but by that time I was so enthusiastic that I set up a little lab in the basement of our house and found another very enthusiastic person. In those days at Harvard, seats were assigned alphabetically so that the persons you knew best in the class all had names beginning with D. And so Aldrich Durant was... the two of us set up a lab and tried both, you know, in the time that was available to us at Harvard and at the time at home, make this cysts-dibromocyclohexane. What's the impact of having done that? Just to be doing something by oneself, on one's own. You identify with that problem, I guess. It's yours. It's your chance to create something. God knows, it's very hard for me to look back my emotional attitude was. There's no question about the enthusiasm and the spending hours and hours and hours of that. There's also no question that if Harvard College had been 5 years, I would have flunked out. My freshman year, I got 4 A's. And from then on, it really went downhill. And I managed to graduate cum laude on the basis of grades obtained in the early part of my college career, but certainly not the latter part. So because I was doing, you know, spending more time on this little project and then spending a lot of time on the sociology and the curriculum. Classes for me were for the birds by then.
What other chemistry courses did you take? Analytical?
Analytical chemistry with Gregory Baxter, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, he was the follower of Richards, I think Baxter was. And that was that was really great for the rest of my life, that the notion of precision as opposed to accuracy the attention to detail that goes into analytical work, the notion that you do have some control over the experimental errors involved. And he had one very nice experiment. It's just learning how to use the microbalance. And of course, in those days, it wasn't a matter of pushing buttons and waiting for the number to come up on a screen, but you were watching this. You did that too. Watching this pointer swing, and you would write down the left hand, the numbers with the left hand swing, and the numbers with the right hand swing, and finally average them up and take it. Well, he of course at one point said, well, now you've got to do that 10 times to find out just how good you are vis-a-vis that balance, because at the end of 8 or 10 times you can get a standard deviation on the weight. And then he said, by the end of the course you'll do it again and to see how you compare, whether you now do any better in handling this balance. there were really some little things of that sort that change one's attitude towards one's work. And in organic chemistry, so much of it is qualitative, but to have had that that quantitative attitude firmly implanted, and to have a high respect for it, was very valuable. Gregory P. Baxter. And then I took a course in old Shannon Forbes, George Shannon Forbes, and I don't remember whether it was, I remember so little about the course, I just struggled with that course because it was largely inorganic chemistry, and he was the dullest lecturer I think I have ever heard in my life. And I was excited about other things, and here all I could do was to learn this stuff. There was no unifying themes, even a small unifying principles involved. And oh God, I worked so hard in that course finally to get a B minus in it, and didn't have much impact. So
so you had pretty well decided that you were going to get your PhD under Kohler's influence, and then he died.
And then he died. That's right. And I think that was, you know, quite a serious experience for me, because, well, I have wondered since that if one is a person without much self-confidence, one then doesn't latch on to certain persons as anchors, if you will, or as figures who are going to help you through. might be a very difficult part of your life. And but in any event, they brought on Carl Noller. Remember Carl Noller? He wrote a textbook.
Yes, I remember. Big Green Textbook.
Big Green Textbook, that's right, Carl Noller.
He was at Stanford.
He was at Stanford, and he came on as a visiting professor. Now, what the devil they were doing, suggesting to a first-year graduate student that he do his research work with someone who was only going to be there for 1 year, I'll be dipped. I mean, I just don't understand how they allowed it. What were you doing? Well, anyway, I decided I would work with Noller. By that time, I was clearly somewhat disaffected with Louis. The choice had seemed to be Louis Fieser, and why I wouldn't have thought of young Paul Bartlett, maybe he was too close to my age, or I don't know. But anyway, I decided, yes, I would work with Noller. And what a disastrous year that was, in a scientific sense.
Well, you were doing that phase rule problem.
Well, yeah, but before that, he came on. This will sort of will amuse you, really, because one of the students at Stanford had taken secondary butyl bromide, not a very complicated starting material. This is unbelievable, but it really gives one such an insight to the way most persons were thinking about chemistry in those days. Because Noller was not a nobody, he was one of the rising stars. That star dimmed fairly quickly. But in any event, here he was. His student had taken secondary butyl bromide triethylamine, and in a solvent, an alcohol solvent. And I stated that way because of the way the story developed. And he had obtained a liquid product out of this thing, which had a boiling point. After all, this is long before IR or anything like that. It had a boiling point that wasn't inconsistent with 1,2,3,4 tetramethyl cyclobutane. Now you can visualize how that would have come about. That is, you take two secondary butyl bromides, two molar equivalents of lassos, and you pull out two HBRs to form the four-membered ring. Wouldn't that be exciting? Oh, yes. Yes, that would be tremendously exciting. So I repeated the damn reaction and got this little bit of liquid just as his student had. And there wasn't much you could do with it. You could get it analyzed. And it clearly was not a hydrocarbon because C and H didn't add up. They weren't the right ratio, so it was something else. So I figured around, and well, it turned out that the solvent that this guy had used, and therefore I had used, was isobutyl alcohol. And I don't ask me why, in God's name, anyone would have used triethylamine and isobutyl alcohol. Upshot of it was this liquid was an ether, secondary butyl isobutyl ether, which of course I synthesized independently, showed that they were right. At least it was an unknown compound. But it's fascinating, isn't it, how how the thinking was at the time, that you could even imagine making tetramethyl cyclobutane by pulling out two HBIs from secondary butyl bromide. Absolutely fascinating. So it was then after that that he said, well, I'm very interested in the Grignard reagent, and the question of dialkyl magnesium, magnesium bromide, and that business. Well, actually, we didn't go to work on the on the making of dialkyl magnesium, which at that time was done usually by precipitating out the magnesium bromide, that's right, with dioxan, but rather investigated this phase diagram. So I learned how to make anhydrous magnesium bromide.